You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good afternoon. My name is Ron Haskins, along with Belle Sawhill, who's playing hooky right now, I guess. We co-direct the Center on Children and Families here at Brookings. We've had a long day of discussions, started this morning with Senator Gillibrand, and now we've been talking about poverty and opportunity and mobility in the United States. Quite fascinating. We had great people here. And in our relentless attempt to be nonpartisan or bipartisan, we begin the day with a Democrat and then the day with Chairman Paul Ryan of the Budget Committee. Here's something that might surprise you. Knowledge counts for a lot in Congress. Paul Ryan's career illustrates this claim. First, he's a former congressional staffer, and we all know that they're necessarily brilliant. And second, upon arriving in Congress, he looked around and asked himself, what makes this place run? The answer, of course, is money. And the budget is the source of all money. So he decided he's going to learn more about the federal budget than anybody else. And within an hour or two, he knew more about the budget than anybody up on the Hill. Of course, most senior positions on the Hill are based on merit and logic. So it was natural that he would become the head of the Budget Committee. Here's another thing that might surprise you. Before he was so interested in the budget, he was very interested in issues having to do with poverty and opportunity, especially opportunity. He had top staffers in this area, which is always a key to understanding what a member of Congress is really concerned about. And recently he's been doing an amazing thing, which is spending a lot of time in inner cities and other poor communities meeting with people who run programs for the poor. This is not exactly on the top of the list of most Republican members of Congress, so it's quite an amazing thing. So let's see what he's learning by visiting these poor communities and what policies they are driving him to. So Chairman Ryan.
Thanks so much, Ron. And I saw Belle. There's Belle right there. I saw Belle over in the hallway, and she and I and Ron had a great talk the other day. I'm a big fan of what they do and their work. And I want to thank you for coming up. I used to come to Brookings and crack these jokes about coming out of the incubator and the cocoon of the conservative think tank area. But this is like my fifth time in this very room, I think. So I don't think I can crack those jokes anymore. I feel comfortable coming over here these days. Don't hold that against me, though. Yeah, right, exactly. I even made it through your report on social mobility, the whole thing. It came out 6 years ago. I read it last week. But I'm grateful you invited me here, too, and I'm very pleased to see this conversation occurring. Now, Ron and Belle, they asked me to talk about two things. First, how do I see the issue of opportunity? Second, what are some ideas to increase opportunity? In other words, what is opportunity and how do we get more of it? Here's how I see it. Behind every opportunity is someone who takes a chance. You mentor a child. You advise a student. You hire somebody. Two people, normally strangers, they form a bond, and they work together to create value, to spread knowledge, to help each other. So I would say that the key to opportunity is trust. And government, when used wisely, can increase that trust. Take one example, interstate highway system. That's something we all could agree on. Of course, the federal government should build the interstate highway system because that would actually encourage interstate commerce. And it did for a simple reason. It got people to interact. And the more people interact, the more they trust each other. And as we all know, where there is trust, there is collaboration. Where there is collaboration, there is economic growth. So to me, when it comes to judging a particular policy reform, I've got a really simple test. Does it bring people together or does it pull them apart? Does it increase trust and collaboration or does it stifle them? Government is a very powerful tool. Too powerful, you might say. Just as it can build and encourage, it can frustrate and deter. You know, as a conservative, I look at Ronald Reagan and look at his insights. One of his great insights was that taxes don't just take money out of people's pockets. They can end up taking people out of the workforce. They discourage people from putting in that extra hour or from hiring that extra worker. And so just as government can increase opportunity, government can destroy it as well. And perhaps there is no better example of government's ability to disappoint, to miss the mark, than LBJ's war on poverty. This month marks the 50th anniversary of that war. And for years, politicians have pointed to the money that they have spent or the programs that they have created. But despite our spending trillions of dollars, 47 million people live in poverty. It's 15% of our fellow citizens. It's one out of seven people. It's the highest rate in a generation. We're spending a lot, and it's just not working. It's missing its mark. Well, why? I think it all goes back to opportunity. Poverty is not just some form of deprivation. It is a form of isolation. If there's anything that I've been learning, it's that. What do we know about the poor? Ron would say three things. They're less likely to have graduated from high school, they're less likely to work full-time, and they're less likely to have gotten married before they had kids. They're cut off from three crucial sources of support: education, work, and family. Now, government isn't solely responsible for these trends, but in other ways, government is deepening the divide. Over the past 50 years, it has built up a hodgepodge of programs in a furious attempt to replace these missing links. And because these programs are so disorganized and dysfunctional, they pull families closer to government and away from society in so many ways. Our goal should be to reintegrate the poor into our communities, but Washington is walling them up as if they're in some massive quarantine. As my friend Senator Mike Lee says, we need to bring in the poor to expand their access to our economy and our civil society. They are not fulfilling their potential, and we are all missing out. We have to remember that poverty is not some rare disease from which the rest of us are all immune. It is but the worst strain of a widespread disease, otherwise known as economic insecurity. Most families worry about making ends meet. All of us have felt isolated at times. That's why concern for the poor, it is not some policy niche. This cannot be some box checked on some new contract with America. This goes to the very, very heart of the American experiment itself. So, how do we bring in the poor? How can the federal government help? I'm afraid I don't have all the answers, but a little humility in Washington might be a good start. Today, I'd like to talk about a few ways to improve our anti-poverty efforts. Here are two key ideas: simplicity and standards. I think they would help with one big problem that we call the poverty trap. You see, it turns out the central planners aren't very good at planning after all. Washington tackles problems in a haphazard whack-a-mole approach, and poverty is no exception. It is just the nature of the beast. So, before Lyndon Johnson even became president, we had Social Security and AFTC. Johnson added Medicaid, Head Start, and Job Corps, among others. Soon after he left office, Washington kept adding to the alphabet soup: the CSFP, the CCDBG, the SCHIP, the list goes on. Gene Sturley, down at the Urban Institute, he has done some really interesting work on this topic. Because the federal government created different programs to solve different problems at different times, there is little to no coordination among them. And because these programs are means-tested, meaning families become ineligible for them as they make more money, poor families effectively face very high marginal tax rates. Government actually discourages them from making more money. What does this mean? Let's take a single mom with two kids living in Colorado. If her income jumps from $10,000 to $40,000, she won't keep much of that extra $30,000. Instead, she'll lose most of it to higher taxes and benefit cuts. According to Sturley's calculations, if she's enrolled in programs like food stamps, Medicaid, and SCHIP, her implicit marginal tax rate will be as high as 55%. And if she's enrolled in other programs like housing assistance and welfare, the rate will reach above 80%. In other words, you go to work and you'll keep less than 20 cents of every extra dollar you earn. Now, I'm sure she's not going to walk around with a calculator saying, what is my implicit marginal tax rate? But she gets it. She is trying to get ahead, and her government is holding her back. This has to be addressed. And the good news is there's a better way to do this. Policymakers are working on a solution to this problem all around. Simplicity. In 2012, Britain produced a far-reaching reform called the Universal Credit. The government's now putting this idea into practice. And it is going through a rough patch. There are no two ways about that. Maybe you've discussed that here today. But the basic concept is very sound. We should learn from their experience. It took six means-tested programs ranging from housing benefits to income support, and it collapsed into one overall payment. The old programs, they cut off abruptly once a family made a certain amount of money. On the other hand, the universal credit tapers off gradually. We've got some experience with this sort of an idea ourselves. We had the earned income tax credit. The minimum wage, it makes it more expensive for employers to hire low-skilled workers. But the EITC, on the other hand, gives workers a boost without hurting their prospects. Many economists have found that the EITC increases employment among low-skilled workers. And like a universal credit, it gives families more flexibility. It helps them take ownership of their lives. Now, there's certainly room for improvement. Just last week, my friend Senator Marco Rubio, he proposed that workers get assistance once a month instead of once a year, so it's easier for them to plan ahead. That's an idea, in my opinion, that makes a lot of sense. But whatever form assistance takes place, we have to encourage work. In other words, there should be standards. It's not a novel concept. In 1996, Congress began to require people on welfare to work. And welfare rolls, they dropped dramatically. Child poverty fell by double digits. The problem is, we have not applied this principle far enough. We need to do more. As Ron likes to say, a man who was involved at that moment, what works is work. And we need to change the way we think about work. It is not a penalty. It is the shortest, surest route back into society. If you're working, you're meeting people. You're learning new skills. You're contributing to society. That is the best way to get a raise or even get a better job. We want people back in the workforce so that they can share their talents and their skills with the rest of us. We are losing out just as much as they are. In short, federal assistance should not be a way station. It ought to be an on-ramp, a quick drive back into the hustle and bustle of life. We've got a lot more work to do. We have to tackle a whole host of issues. Education, criminal justice and criminal reform, health care. But reformers at the state and local level, they're already doing a lot of this hard work. The federal government should let them take the lead and learn from their example. I like to think that anything I've said here is not very radical, but you can already hear the howls of protest from certain corners. All I would say to the critics who are criticizing new ideas and perhaps new thinking in a more effective war on poverty, all I would say is we want to hear their ideas too. Good intentions are not enough. Concern for the poor does not demand a commitment to the status quo. It demands a commitment to results. We should not measure our success by how much we spend on welfare. We should measure our success by how many people we help get off of welfare. Later this year, I plan on saying a whole lot more about this subject. But before I roll out any policy prescriptions for poor families, I need to hear more from the real experts, the families themselves. If there's one thing I've learned after 15 years in Congress, it is that Washington does not have all the answers. In fact, sometimes they are right under our noses and right out in our communities, not in this city. My mom used to always tell me, son, you have two ears and one mouth. Use them in that proportion. Somewhere in Congress, I lost sight of that a time or two. But I think all of us who care so deeply about this issue, not as a niche, but as part of the growing American experiment, we have to heed that kind of advice. Just as we need to run the numbers and study up on the issues, we need to listen to the people we are trying to help, because they're the people on the front lines. Only the people in the community can solve the problems facing their community. And trust, that is the bedrock of opportunity. And the federal government, it has to trust them. With all due respect to all the brilliant minds here at Brookings and those lesser lights over on Capitol Hill, we need all hands on deck. We need to enlist these poverty fighters, the people who never come to Washington. We need to enlist these community leaders and these working families in the real war on poverty. There is only one way to beat poverty, and that is face-to-face. For too long, too many people have watched this effort from a distance. You know, it's like this. They've said to themselves, I'm working hard, I'm paying my taxes, government's going to take care of this. And in so many ways, the government has reinforced and encouraged this view. That's not going to cut it anymore. We need everyone to get in this game. We need everyone to get involved, person to person, community to community, face to face. And the truth is, when you're helping people in need, you're helping yourself. So if we reintegrate the poor in our communities, we will reinvigorate our country overall. Because a country with healthy growing families will have a healthy growing economy. We will all benefit from the economic and personal growth. At its best, collaboration does not just build a growing economy, it builds character. It makes us better people. It will make us a better country. So Ron and Bell, I want to thank you for your invitation. I enjoy the conversation we're about to have. I look forward to it. And I think that it's vital that we make every single citizen, every single one of them, a full participant in the American experiment. And if we have a vibrant battle of ideas on how best to achieve these outcomes, we will get there and we will make this moment what it is. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Good to go.
Thank you. Interesting remarks. I bet a lot of people in the audience are reflecting on them and thinking about the questions they'd like to ask you, but I'm the one that gets to ask you the questions. So a lot of what you say has a ring of what in the old days used to be called compassionate conservatism. Are you a compassionate conservative, and what is a compassionate conservative?
I don't like that term or the premise of it, because it presumes that conservatism itself is not compassionate. So I'm not a big fan of the term compassionate conservatism. I believe that conservatism, as I understand it, otherwise probably known as classical liberalism, is the most compassionate form of government because it respects the dignity of the individual. Its goal and attempt is to help the most people have the best life and to reach their potential. We have to fight for better ideas to make sure that we realize the American experiment. What is that to me? The condition of your birth does not determine the outcome of your life. That's what I was raised, you know, growing up in a small town Irish Catholic family from immigrants that came over from the potato famine. That's the American idea as I understood it. My big fear, you, Bell, everybody around here has documented this so well, Stuart over at Heritage, is we're starting to lose sight of that. We're losing not only mobility, we understand that, but whole generations of Americans don't know what this is. And when you explain it or tell it to them, they don't think it's for them. That's a problem. And I do believe that conservatism is the best answer for this. Otherwise, I wouldn't be who I am.
But I know the answer to this next question, but it'll get a laugh anyway. And I think it expresses what many on the left think about compassion conservatism. Tony Blair said, the only difference between compassion conservatism and conservatism is that under compassionate conservatism, they tell you they're not going to help you, but they're really sorry they're not going to help you. Now, I'm going to guess wildly that you disagree with that. But this does show the left makes jokes about this sort of thing. I realize you don't like the term, but many of the things you discuss are, I think, part and parcel of what most people think of, you know, local, working face-to-face,
right,
helping people in the place where they live, listening to them and so forth. All these used to come under the head of compassion conservatism. So what do you say to people on the left saying, That's not going to cut it.
Well, if those who are advocates of the status quo or who advocated for the status of where we are right now say just do more of this, that doesn't cut it. And for those who say it could be worse, that's hardly an effective answer. So what do we mean when we say conservatism or why we have better ideas? I truly believe that we have made the mistake in this war on poverty, an unintended consequence, mind you, that we have displaced community, that we have crowded out and pushed aside what many of us call civil society, and we have told people in this country that it is no longer their responsibility to help care for others. Now, that is not saying this is just a convenient excuse for cutting a program or stopping the federal government's role and just saying it's up to people locally. No, I'm not trying to say that. What I'm trying to say is I think the left made the mistake in thinking this is all about material deprivation. And what we ended up doing, we isolated people in our communities and we put up walls separating people from integrating with each other. We need to tear down those walls. We need to look at how these programs are actually doing harm, trapping people in poverty, and how we can refocus on an agenda of upward mobility, of turning that escalator back on and getting people back into life. Now, I always hesitate to say this because as a person in government, it sounds preachy, but you cannot ignore the culture. You've written all this stuff about marriage, about the breakdown of family. These things cannot be ignored. But it is not somebody in Washington who's going to solve that. That is our culture. That is our communities. That is our churches. That is our media, everything. But as conservatives working in government to make a difference, we can remove a lot of barriers that are harming our culture. We can move a lot of barriers that are slowing down income mobility, that are harming economic growth and opportunity. And those are the kinds of things that I think we should focus on. That, to me, is what a proactive, positive, conservative solution would look like.
Republicans are intent on making government smaller, and this means they cut programs. Many people see you as a hero because you've been a leader in this movement and tried to balance the budget and cut programs, and we have indeed cut programs. Do you think, is that a necessary part of your war on poverty, of your attempt to help poor people to cut programs?
It has nothing to do with a line on a spreadsheet. It has nothing to do with what the number ought to be. It has everything to do is this working or not? And working meaning, are people getting on with their lives and hitting their potential? Are people having the best chance to make the most of their life in this country or society? And I do believe that freedom, free enterprise, brought forth by keeping government limited is the way to go, is the way to maximize that. Now, that doesn't mean that we believe in no government. What that means is we believe in a government that is effective. We believe in a government that looks to its role and does that very effectively, and we are not doing that. We're biting off more than we can chew. We're crowding out civil society. We're presuming that we can replace these missing links in society that just can't be replaced by anything other than, you know, family. And so I look at this fight we have because I do believe we will lose this century as an American century if we go down the path we are on. It doesn't matter whether you read Charles Murray or Bob Putnam or any of these folks. We have a dangerous demographic, a dangerous trajectory we are on in this country. The budget's part of that. The entitlement and debt explosion are part of that. The economy and slower economic growth are a big part of that. But the greatest casualty of this dangerous trajectory are the least among us, the poor who are being trapped in poverty. And so I really believe we need to take a look at this. And when we apply our principles, liberty, freedom, free enterprise, self-determination, subsidiarity is a term people of my faith use, along with solidarity and community, you can have a rich, vibrant mosaic of a society where people can really make the most of their lives, where we can get back to those days of upward mobility, where people come to this country or are born in this country and say, you know what, I can make it. I can do it. I can be who I want to be. We can get there if we really compete for these outcomes. And if we measure all of this stuff by how much money we throw at it, how many, what the spreadsheet looks like, how many tax dollars you can put into something, we will miss the mark. But if we measure based on outcome and results, then I feel like we can make a difference.
So let's assume you're right and that the real problem is government and too many programs and removing too much authority and responsibility from local levels and churches and so forth. Can you actually foresee that you could convince some of the people in this audience and the people in the media and voters of Wisconsin and the rest of the country, especially states like New York and California, that that's true and that government is really in the way, and that if you balance the budget and cut spending and have these kind of community initiatives that you're talking about, that it'll be a better result?
Yes.
Do you think you can convince them of that?
Why would I be doing this if I didn't believe that?
Well, there are a lot of people that do that. There are a lot of people.
I mean, honestly.
Some people call it a heroic act to know that you probably can't convince people, but you know you're right, and you're going to try to explain.
Yeah, I'm not one of those people who likes. Look, a friend of mine once said, you don't want to be sitting on your front porch in your rocking chair with your grandkid on your knees saying, you know what, you know, granddaughter, you know, I want you to know, while America went to hell in a handbasket, I just want you to know I voted no every step of the way. You know, I do believe that a majority of Americans understand that what's going on today is not working, that our society is fraying at the seams, that we have to do something different, that the status quo isn't working, and that I think new ideas based on these ideals that were the founding principles of our country that made us so special and great in the first place, I really do believe that a majority of Americans can warm to this, can agree with this, can embrace this. If I didn't believe that, why would I be doing this? I mean, what's the point? So do I believe that the principles of welfare reform, which were majoritarian principles in 1996, can be that way again? Yes, they were. The results were very effective. Do I believe that Americans want able-bodied people to have a better chance at a better life? And do I think Americans want a safety net that's effective, that is there for the truly indigent people in need? Yes. Conservatives believe that too. So I think what happens in these debates is we just caricaturize each other. We just lump somebody into a caricature, as in this is a liberal who just cares nothing about growing government and taking power from people and debt and deficits and blah, 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 blah. Or this is a conservative who's heartless, who doesn't care, who just wants, you know, to help the rich, who just wants, you know, no government. You know what? It's probably somewhere way in the middle between those two spheres. And so I think if we just rely on these caricatures, we'll just do this the whole time. We'll just smash against each other. But if we actually have a adult conversation about how to restore economic mobility, a conversation about our culture, which is inherently non-government, I think that's pretty important. I think we can make a difference. And I do believe that a majority of Americans still believe in the American dream, the American idea. And if they knew they could do something to make a difference in their communities and help advance it, they'll do it. And I do believe that this can be done. Yes, I do.
Okay, so I'm going to end by inviting you back to Brookings. When you get ready to say exactly what your agenda is going to be, as you promised during the speech, I hope you'll come back here and tell a big audience. I suspect we'll have an even bigger audience to hear the specifics that you'd like to.
After Heritage, right, Stuart?
Yeah. No, before Heritage.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for coming.
My pleasure.
It was
thanks
wonderful.
For having me. Appreciate
and please join me in thanking Chairman Ryan.
Thanks.